You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah.
This is WBCR LP, 97.7 on your FM dial, broadcasting from downtown Great Barrington in the Berkshire Hills of Western Massachusetts. That was The Doors. And this is Mickey Friedman. And this is The Other Side. There are, of course, many sides and many truths. This show is about some of the other sides of the story. My pick of the many stories out there. The war goes on. Sometimes I feel like I'm in Wonderland, and wonder exactly when we all fell down that rabbit hole.
Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
11 years ago, as a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War, the Iraqi regime was required to destroy its weapons of mass destruction, to cease all development of such weapons, and to stop all support for terrorist groups. The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations. It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons. It has given shelter and support to terrorism and practices terror against its own people. The entire world has witnessed Iraq's 11-year history of defiance, deception, and bad faith. We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001, America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth. We resolved then, and we are resolved today, to confront every threat from any source that could bring sudden terror and suffering to America. Saddam Hussein is a homicidal dictator who is addicted to weapons of mass destruction. Some ask how urgent this danger is to America and the world. The danger is already significant, and it only grows worse with time. If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons? In 1995, after several years of deceit by the Iraqi regime, the head of Iraq's military industries defected. It was then that the regime was forced to admit that it had produced more than 30,000 liters of anthrax and other deadly biological agents. The inspectors, however, concluded that Iraq had likely produced 2 to 4 times that amount. This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons that has never been accounted for and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas. And surveillance photos reveal that the regime is rebuilding facilities that it had used to produce chemical and biological weapons. Every chemical and biological weapon that Iraq has or makes is a direct violation of the truce that ended the Persian Gulf War in 1991. Yet Saddam Hussein has chosen to build and keep these weapons despite international sanctions, UN demands, and isolation from the civilized world. Iraq possesses ballistic missiles with a likely range of hundreds of miles, far enough to strike Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey, and other nations in a region where more than 135,000 American civilians and service members live and work. We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
One of the most worrisome things that emerges from the thick intelligence file we have on Iraq's biological weapons is the existence of mobile production facilities used to make biological agents. We have first-hand descriptions of biological weapons factories on wheels and on rails. The source was an eyewitness, an Iraqi chemical engineer who supervised one of these facilities. This defector is currently hiding in another country with a certain knowledge that Saddam Hussein will kill him if he finds him. A second source, an Iraqi civil engineer in a position to know the details of the program, confirmed the existence of transportable facilities moving on trailers. A third source, also in a position to know, reported in summer 2002 that Iraq had manufactured mobile production systems mounted on road trailer units and on rail cars. Finally, a fourth source, an Iraqi major who defected, confirmed that Iraq has mobile biological research laboratories in addition to the production facilities I mentioned earlier. Just a few weeks ago, we intercepted communications between two commanders in Iraq's 2nd Republican Guard Corps. One commander is going to be giving an instruction to the other. Two officers talking to each other on the radio want to make sure that nothing is misunderstood. Remove the expression, I got it. Nerve agents, wherever it comes up, got it, wherever it comes up, in the wireless instructions, I got it. Why does he repeat it that way? Why is he so forceful in making sure this is understood? And why did he focus on wireless instructions? Because the senior officer is concerned that somebody might be listening. Well, somebody was. Nerve agents. Stop talking about it. They're listening to us.
Moreover, since September 11th, we have seen a new means of delivering these weapons, terrorist networks. To the extent that they might transfer WMD to terrorist groups, they could conceal their responsibility for attacks on our people. So I submit, Mr. Chairman, that we are on notice that an attack will likely be attempted. It's a question of when and by what technique. It could be months or years, but it will happen. If the worst were to happen, not one of us here today would be able to honestly say that it was a surprise, because it will not be a surprise. We have connected the dots as much as is humanly possible before the fact. Only by waiting until after the event could we have proof positive, and then it, of course, would be late. The question facing us is this: what is the responsible course of action for our country? With our history, our tradition, do we believe it is our responsibility to wait for a chemical or biological or even nuclear September 11th? Or is it the responsibility of free people to take steps to deal with the threat before we are attacked? There are a number of terrorist states pursuing weapons of mass destruction: Iran, Libya, North Korea, Syria, just to name a few. But no terrorist state poses a greater or more immediate threat to the security of our people than the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall with continuing live coverage of the war in Iraq. And within the past hour, we've been seeing dramatic pictures of the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, coming under aerial bombardment for the third night running. But it's quite clear from the pictures that we are seeing enormous balls of flame and large plumes of smoke rising over the city, that this is significantly different from the two previous nights, and indeed Pentagon officials have told reporters that this is a beginning of a major aerial bombardment of Iraq. Raghi, certainly incredibly dramatic pictures on the television of this aerial bombardment tonight of Baghdad.
Yeah, it's full wood. I can see from my balcony a huge plume of black smoke towards the southwest of Baghdad. I think that's the oil refinery. In a 180-degree arc, I can see it must be half the buildings on the skyline seem to be in flames. Clearly, targets have been hit repeatedly. Another white flash in the distance there. You might have heard that one. That was pretty close. Anti-aircraft fire has ceased. I think they've just been pummeled into submission on the southwest corner. Another flash, I think that one coming in. Yeah, anti-aircraft fire again. Clearly this is what the Pentagon had promised. This is the massive rolling attack, which we're fearing to happen. It has begun.
And Paul, it does seem from the television pictures as if large parts of the city are ablaze, and I'm looking now at what looks to be a mushroom cloud rising over Baghdad.
I believe that is one of the presidential palaces. There is so much smoke now obscuring our view, it is hard to be precise, but in a complete 180-degree arc from where I'm speaking, every single building I can see is in flames, is billowing smoke. I would guess, counting the big explosions, which were close to us, 20 or 30, and in the distance, there are still small explosions going on.
And it seems impossible to think that bombing on this scale and of this intensity could not cause civilian casualties. This can no longer be the kind of precision bombing that necessarily has been engaged in the previous couple of days.
American-led forces are continuing to press north through Iraq, bypassing Iraqi strong points. They've encountered resistance en route, but according to the American military commander, General Tommy Franks, Iraqi strong points, which are not of strategic significance, are being bypassed, and good progress, he said, was being made.
Our forces are continuing to move. They're moving in ways. We know for a fact that the forces on this battlefield are the most capable, certainly the most capable I've ever seen, whether it's by way of technology or training or motivation. Our resolve is great, the morale is good, and as I think we always say, there is no doubt about the outcome.
On the line from northern Kuwait, from British Forces headquarters, is our correspondent, Kylie Morris. Kylie, what are the British saying?
Well, they're saying exactly that and no more at this stage. They say simply that the word is from Basra that there is some kind of civilian uprising underway.
The British troops... carry on.
They, of course, have been working toward this, if it is in fact the case. They've been dropping thousands of pamphlets over the past few days. They've been dropping wind-up radios into the town. They've been broadcasting from loudspeakers to try and convince the civilian population of Basra that this is not an invasionary force, this is a liberation force, and that they should come out into the streets, if you like, and overthrow the Ba'athist militias in the city. However, contrary to that message, things hadn't been going the way of the British. That's why they had said only in the last 24 hours that Basra had become a military objective for them, that there was heavy artillery engagement involving the British 7th Armoured Brigade on the outskirts and Iraqi army within the city itself. So if this has in fact happened, it's quite a surprise.
Because originally they were not trying to take Basra, they were not trying to engage.
No, there was a sense, it would seem, that as the Americans tore off toward Baghdad, that there wasn't really time to mop up these cities along the way. I think Qasr was some kind of an indication that this kind of street fighting was going to take a lot of time and should be, well, it was best avoided. I think what the British were hoping for was that there would be some kind of an uprising in Basra, and that that would lead to, that would create space, if you like, for the British to be welcomed into the city without having to fight. Now, in the past 24 hours, they've said, all right, we might have to have a fight.
The British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, confronted these issues today. His view is that once the Iraqis are free to express their true feelings, they'll welcome the invasion.
Iraq and its security apparatus exists to support the regime of Saddam Hussein. Nobody should be surprised, therefore, that there are parts of the armed forces determined to fight. For they know that when the regime falls, which it will, they will have nowhere to go. Nor should anyone be surprised that until the Iraqi people know for sure that the regime that they despise is on the way out, they will hold back, a point now being made by Iraqi exiles. They've been let down before, when they thought coalition forces were going to remove Saddam. And my message to them today is that this time we will not let you down. Saddam and his regime will be removed. Iraq will have a better future ahead of it.
Mr. Blair was asked how the US-led troops would avoid civilian casualties and damaging infrastructure in their planned move into Baghdad.
All the way through, we have done everything we can to protect the infrastructure of services. We've done everything we can to spare the civilian population. Of course there will be civilian casualties. I think they have been far fewer than people anticipated. And the very reason why we wanted to make sure that the land campaign started at the same time, if not slightly predating, the air campaign, was in order to demonstrate this is not a situation where we're trying to bomb Iraq into submission and then send in land forces afterwards. This is a situation in which we're combining land and air in such a way that we try and minimise the suffering to Iraqi people.
The British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, speaking in Washington, President Bush said the campaign was on a steady advance and making good progress. He said the forces were displaying bravery and they'll be victorious.
We cannot know the duration of this war, yet we know its outcome. We will prevail.
to Ohio, but my pretty countryside had been paved down the middle by a government that had no pride. The farms of Ohio had been replaced by shopping malls, and music filled the air from Seneca to Cahoga Falls. Said, hey, oh, way to go, Ohio.
In the South and the West and the North that coalition forces control is substantial. It is, happens not to be the area where weapons of mass destruction were dispersed. We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and East, West, South, and North somewhat.
But it wouldn't be disappointing, would it, if there were no weapons there?
We know for a fact that there are weapons there.
Thank you all very much. Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Well, first of all, we'll put together a force structure to meet the threats on the ground. And we got a lot of forces there ourselves. And as I said yesterday, anybody who wants to harm American troops will be found and brought to justice. There are some who feel like that if they attack us, that we may decide to leave prematurely. They don't understand what they're talking about if that's the case. Let me finish. There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on. We got the force necessary to deal with the security situation.
Has given you the call. Mr. Chairman. On page 64 of your report, you say that the survey group has not found evidence that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction stocks prior to the war. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, what you're telling us in addition to that today is that in addition to having no WMD stocks before the war, for the reasons you gave, Saddam chose not to have those weapons. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Those are stunning statements. Not only did he not have weapons of mass destruction, but for the reasons you gave, he chose not to have weapons of mass destruction. That is 180 degrees different from what the administration was saying prior to the war. And you also found on page 7 that Iraq did not possess a nuclear device, nor had it tried to reconstitute a capability to produce nuclear weapons after 1991. Did I read that correctly from your report?
Sir, I'm sure you read it correctly.
But I want to now get to your nuclear program statement. You say that you found, as a matter of fact, that Iraq had not tried to reconstitute a capability to produce nuclear weapons after 1991. Are you saying, therefore, it seems to me, that Iraq had no active nuclear weapons reconstitution program before the war? Is that correct?
What we said was there was an attempt to sustain the intellectual capability and to sustain some elements of the program, particularly before 1995. But active nuclear weapons program, no. We found no evidence, nor do we judge that there was one.
All right. Now, relative to the aluminum tubes, your report says on page 21 that Baghdad's interest in high-strength, high-specification aluminum tubes is best explained by its efforts to produce 81-millimeter rockets. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is my judgment, that those tubes were most likely destined for a rocket program.
Now, you also found on page 7 in the nuclear section that the survey group has uncovered no information to support allegations of Iraqi pursuit of uranium from abroad. And in another page, you said that the survey group has found no evidence, excuse me, has not found evidence to show that Iraq sought uranium from abroad after 1991. Is that your judgment?
That is also what we found.
Now, relative to the mobile biological weapon production program, this is what you've stated in your report. In spite of exhaustive investigation, the survey group found no evidence that Iraq possessed or was developing BW agent production systems mounted on road vehicles or railway wagons. Is that your conclusion?
That, I'm going to go a little longer on my response to that, because it is a more complicated question or issue. And the biology area is one where there's less certainty possible. And part of that is due to the nature of the programs. If you were to do sensitivity analysis about that, you know, little facts can make a big difference in that area. On the mobile production systems question, there were two trailers which were found in, I believe it was May of 2003, one in Erbil and one in Mosul. Those are clearly, in my judgment, for the production of hydrogen. They have absolutely nothing to do with any biological weapons. A second question, though, arose from reports, largely from one individual, about a production facility which was mobile. These were quite detailed reports, and to the extent we have been able to investigate that, we believe two things. One, that much of what this person said is incorrect. Some of what he did say was correct, but the majority of the evidence which he was pointing to as a mobile production facility was wrong. However, this is one of those issues where I'm not quite comfortable in pronouncing that there was no mobile system in Iraq. We believe we've done as much investigation as we can. We have found no evidence. But as from, I feel a little bit hesitant about declaring flatly that there was no mobile production facility. It's one of those cases where there may be some uncertainty.
And just in conclusion, though, the two trailers that were captured in 2003 that were stated to be part of a VW program for the delivery of VW, manufacturer of VW, those particular trailers you have found were, in fact, not part of a VW program.
Correct.
Is that correct? Because those are the two trailers that the vice president pointed to as being definitely the evidence of the VW program and the evidence of weapons of mass destruction. Those were the very trailers that the vice president said, this is the definitive evidence that Saddam Hussein had a weapons of mass destruction program, and now you're coming here today relative to those two trailers and telling us that in spite of exhaustive investigation, you found no evidence that Iraq possessed or was developing VW agent production systems mounted on road vehicles or railway wagons, and that those particular trailers were designed and built exclusively for the generation of hydrogen.
The two trailers that that were captured in Erbil and Mosul were for the production of hydrogen. In my judgment, my firm judgment, and the judgment of most of the people who have looked at them, all of our experts, they have nothing to do with biological weapons.
Well, thank you for that testimony. It just totally undercuts the statements which were made by the vice president. Thank you.
Charles Dolfer has now issued a comprehensive report that confirms the earlier conclusion of David Kaye that Iraq did not have the weapons that our intelligence believed were there. The Dolfer report also raises important new information about Saddam Hussein's defiance of the world and his intent and capability to develop weapons. The Dolfer report showed that Saddam was systematically gaming the system, using the UN Oil for Food program to try to influence countries and companies in an effort to undermine sanctions. He was doing so with the intent of restarting his weapons program once the world looked away. Based on all the information we have to date, I believe we were right to take action, and America is safer today with Saddam Hussein in prison. He retained the knowledge, the materials, the means, and the intent to produce weapons of mass destruction, and he could have passed that knowledge on to our terrorist enemies. Saddam Hussein was a unique threat, a sworn enemy of our country, a state sponsor of terror, operating in the world's most volatile region. In the world after September the 11th, he was the threat we had to confront, and America and the world are safer for our actions. The Dolfer report makes clear that much of the accumulated body of 12 years of our intelligence and that of our allies was wrong, and we must find out why.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all. My empire of dirt, I will let you down. I will make you hurt. I wear this crown of thorns upon my liar's chair, full of broken thoughts I cannot repair. Beneath the stains of time, the feelings disappear. You are someone else. I am still right here. What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all. My empire of dirt. I will let you down. I will make you hurt. If I could start again, a million miles away, I would keep myself. I would find a way.
I look forward to the Intelligence Reform Commission's recommendations, and we will act on them to improve our intelligence, especially our intelligence about weapons of mass destruction.
It's getting worse. I don't know why, really. It was easier the first year after the first year of the war. I shouldn't worry 24 hours about the safety of myself and my children's. You have to lock everything, and you have to watch for everything, and be suspicious of everything. I lock doors, I lock my car every time, and this is my only concern. It keeps me from leading a very normal life, this feeling.
And how different was it before the war?
I can't help thinking that it was, how secure it was. I'm sorry, I have come down to this only. It was very safe. I've forgotten everything. I just remember how safe it was.
So you would return to those days of Saddam Hussein?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't say so. But really, it is sad. We have a sense of freedom now. I agree. It's wonderful. Freedom for travel, for thinking, for saying your opinion. But it's like shadowed by this feeling of insecurity. Doesn't seem there is a hope that it's going to get better any day now. So this is shadowed, this sense of freedom.
And how different was your life before?
Well, we used to lead normal lives. Well, we can't, of course, we couldn't say our opinions about anything, but at least we kept away from the government, but we led normal lives. We socialized, we went to clubs, we went to meetings. We could return by midnight. It was very safe. But we kept away from politics, of course. We couldn't say our opinions. What did we get now? Everything is shattered now because of this sense of insecurity. I feel deceived. I feel abandoned. Because it has been going on for too long now, for 2 years and some time. So what then?
And who's to blame?
I can't say I blame one party. Everyone is blamed. Everyone. I blame everyone.
We are scared to come to work. It's really suffering to come to make this trip from home to the hospital and back. We have now a second wave of immigration or escape, another one like in Saddam time, and we have the second wave now. A big number of doctors have left the country to the neighboring countries or to the Gulf states. I'm very pessimistic. I've never been in the old days been attacked by anybody in my house. Nobody dared. But while I was sitting at night, at 9 o'clock at night, instead of ringing the bell, they knocked with the gun. I opened the door and saw 8 hammers and about 20 soldiers with their guns pointed at us. They said, "We have information that you hold meetings in your house against the coalition armies." I said, "There is no way. I am a well-known doctor, and you've got the wrong address." And they searched the house upside down, and they found nothing. And at the end, he apologized. But when they went in, it was in a Rambo style, with the guns pointed at us. I was very upset. He said, "I'm very sorry. We've got the wrong information." I said, "Yes, I told you you've got the wrong information. But you've just created a good enemy for you."
I start my morning usually at between 6:30 and 7:00 in the morning. I wake up, take a shower, and prepare to go to work. I try not to leave home after 7 or 7:30. Usually the car bombs, usually I say, because it's not always the case, car bombs usually start between 9 and 10 o'clock. I try to be at work before that time. Sometimes they go off at 8 or 8:30, which is very scary. It takes me, on a good day, it takes me about an hour to get to work. On a bad day, it can take up to 2.5 or 3 hours to get to work. The reason for that is that I have to go through various routes for security reasons. I try not to go through the center of Baghdad. I also have to ride a different car every day. And all this would only protect me against personal attacks. But the biggest fear I have is of the car bombs that could kill anyone. It's just like I missed car bombs at least 4 times, maybe more. Once I was less than 50 yards away of 2 car bombs. I was right in the middle. And so when I get to work, I feel safer. You're always safer when you're indoors than when you're outdoors. Although a few weeks ago I had a car bomb quite near to my window, but thankfully everyone at the ministry survived. So I spend the day at the ministry trying to solve whatever problems there are, trying to make things work as much as possible. It's very difficult to do much work, really, within such limited security freedom we have. For more than 20 years, Iraqis haven't been exposed, were not exposed to what was happening in the rest of the world. And so trivial things like writing an email or receiving an email or having a letter typed out is a hassle. What takes usually in the West, say, 30 minutes, it would easily take 3 or 4 days in Iraq. There are other problems as well. Communications are not easy, although there are mobile phones these days, but to get things done takes much longer. Another very important problem we have, which is directly related to the security situation, is that we can have armies within the historic sites, and they have actually damaged a lot of the Iraqi antiquities. And it could be an American army or a Polish army or an Iraqi army. We still suffer from that. And an army is an army, whether it's Genghis Khan or the most powerful and cultured army in the world. It's not much difference, really.
I work in a major hospital in the center of Baghdad. Every morning, I wake up at 6:30 a.m., dressing up for going to work after taking my breakfast. At 7:30, I go out to work mostly with my father, but sometimes I go alone by my car. The hospital is not far away from our house. It takes 30 minutes to get there. But when some roads are blocked, it takes hours. As I reach the hospital, I start my day by taking a morning tour to check the resident patients, but mostly with interruptions as they call us to the emergency room whenever there is a blast or too many injured people there. I have to stay for the whole day till at least 9 p.m. in the hospital, doing my duty in the emergency room as a doctor on call. Sometimes, just for a few minutes, I feel that everything's going just fine, just great, and we can live normally without fears. But as soon as I wake up from my dream, I face the reality. I love my work so much, and I'm enjoying doing it, but sometimes I just hate being a doctor, especially when I can't save someone's life. Real crimes happened here, and many innocent people are dying due to blasts or assassinations. Sometimes we go through a really bloody days, which really breaks my heart. I wish that I could do something to stop the pain and despair. We are fighting here to live. We don't know if we're gonna live for another day or not. Every day I pray to get home safe and my whole family. We are creating something from nothing. We don't have adequate materials, equipment, drugs, or even the simplest things that we need in our work. We don't have even typical theaters for minor or major surgeries or typical emergency management, as we don't have the enough emergency room stuff. We are delayed more and more due to terrorism. That's why I vote in January 2005, and all my family did so. And we will vote even in the next elections for my Iraq, for my beautiful Iraq. I'm proud of being myself, a hopeful Iraqi woman, and I'm completely convinced that things are going better and better, and we're gonna go on building our country and the new civil society. I don't have fears from the future, as I trust in real Iraqi people, and I trust myself. We are full with hopes and dreams, and I believe it will all come true.
I am awaking at about 5 o'clock morning, go to the near mosque to get the prayer of dawn. You see, this time there was always attacks by policemen to the mosques, charging them of terrorism. But we ought to want to get our religion and to proceed this. So I ought to go to mosques, although there is some dangerous situations. Every Iraqi thinking so, because you don't think what will meet you in the road in every hour. You know, there is always bombs, always cars, always killed man. You don't know what happened to you when you leave your house. But you ought to leave for work, for study, for everything. You ought to proceed your ordinary life. There is so many youth people without work. You see, there is injustice and inequality in everything. There is the occupation troops in roads. So the demands of security needs so many things, not only the force.
I'm Umm Mustafa, the hairdresser. I work in a salon for the ladies. And how are things? No electricity, no water. The heat is killing us. And customers, when they peer in, they see only darkness. They shy away, and this is where we're supposed to make a living. What do you reckon? Customers will hang around waiting for electricity to come back? No, they won't. And what's the quintessential thing for a hairdresser? Electricity. To use the generator needs oil, and oil requires a budget, and I'm not the owner, so I can't buy that. I'm merely a hairdresser who works in a salon. But the paradox is that when the owner comes and sees that there are no customers, she refuses to pay us our salaries. This is the situation. There's no security, threats are flying, give up the profession or else. Thank God our salon has not been targeted and we haven't received any threats yet. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't fear for ourselves. I mean, what would it cost to throw a bomb in our direction? But at the same time, what other option do we have? It's simply a risk we have to take. It's our livelihood. And I'm talking about the Iraqi women as a whole. Most of our men are sitting at home. My husband goes out looking for a job every day, in vain. Every day he takes his car and tries to find work, in vain. And this is the kind of life Iraqi women are leading right now. I have two kids who are dependent on me, and I'm pregnant. Yet I'm on my feet all day until I ache all over. But I have to survive. I have to survive. Let's talk about water. There is none, be it winter or summer. Do you know what we ask from our customers? We ask that they buy their water if they want us to do their hair. Can you imagine that? But these are just the conditions in which we have to work these days in Baghdad. Great. We're asking the new Iraqi government to provide us with these three things: security, electricity, and water. We could be happy with these three things.
At this time, precisely, I have to be training in the Freedom Swimming Pool in Baghdad. Before, about 4 or 5 months ago, the swimming pool was, it's like in very delicate security area, which is bounded by the U.S. troops camp and the Ministry of Interior Affairs. So the reaching for this facility was too hard for us. But after, the little progress in the security situation, we were able now to go for a training facility. About 1 year ago, the American camp was near our swimming pool. So they considered this pool as a part of their camp, and they used to come for our swimming pool. And one day, we surprised that we are kicked out from our single swimming pool and our single training center. So we have to go for the officers there at the camp and negotiate with them directly. I went for the front gate of the camp, me and other colleagues with me. So I met a captain there, and I introduced the issue for him. I told him this is the only facility we have training in since many years ago. So he said that we will understand, and we'll make a badges for you to enter this secured area. After about 2 weeks, nothing has changed. We went to the Olympic Committee. They did nothing. Till one day we bring the media to the swimming pool and we clarify the issue for them. Since then, things changed and we are able to go back again for our swimming pool. Yesterday, I set up my alarm clock at 7 a.m. But unfortunately, I was awake before that on the chains and the noises of the wheels of the Humvees and the tanks on the Haifa streets. Our area is, compromised with security. We are many times facing difficulties, to enter our home, to go back to our works, to go for the training, because suddenly things are unexpected. When we go out after 2 hours, you find that Haifa Street is blocked. So things are unpredictable there.
Let me put to you a question that's been emailed to us here. Al has emailed the question: if you could return to your life in Iraq as it was before the invasion, would you?
Well, I would like to go back for this life because it was so secure.
It was more secure?
Yeah,
We hear a lot about the oppression under Saddam Hussein and how difficult life was and how people couldn't express their opinions. You probably wouldn't have been able to talk to me like you are now.
Yeah, indeed. That's correct. Sometimes we had to pay for training. This is an example. When we go for the swimming pool, we have to pay to be trained. But, security is the major role here. We need security. We need security to feel safe. We need security to be trained. We need security to feel free to go and back.
And you don't feel you're going to get that for some time?
Well, I'm not optimistic for the near future.
The lack of security and no peace, frightening. It's concentration on doctors and kidnapping them. All these make our life and our frightening on our kids and our houses and our lives. We are living all the time with fear from everything. And whenever in hospitals, in private clinic, in private hospitals, we are just feeling of fear. And when we go to take our cars, just we are scaring and looking about the situation. If anybody is watching us or following us, just for nothing, we have nothing do wrong, just for fear, that's all. I have to do my work. I have to take my kids to school, and I have to go to my clinic, I have to follow my patients, I have to go to hospitals. At home, we are also afraid from missing a bomb or anything, but at least we know where is the fate of our kids or our life, that if a death is awaiting for us, so we all died and at home. But when you lose your kid and you don't know, once he leaves the home, in the school, in the road, we have from kidnapping, we have from pumping of the school, my little daughter, they pump her school. So all this until we are come back to home and all together, we are afraid, but our frightening is less because all together, and if we die, that we will die all together.
My day has been really busy because I'm having my final exams today, just like so many other students in Iraq today in the universities. I went out to study in friend's house, and just getting out of the house, staying home is really not the best idea to study because there's no electricity and it's really, really, really hot inside. So what you do is you go to like some friend's house, and it took forever to get there. There've been checkpoints in the way, and so it was very, very crowded. And this is very, very common in Baghdad today. The traffic jams are very, very disturbing, really. Anyway, so we studied, we had lunch there, and then again, through a horrible traffic jam, went back home, and I'm studying back home here after we finally got electricity again.
I have to worry about the exam, but also we always worry whether there will be a bomb or an explosion nearby our school or on the way to the school. So, we're starting to get used to it because it's beginning to be a normal fear, because we are just preparing ourselves to face death anytime.
We just heard a very special series of interviews conducted by the BBC on June 7th, 2005, with Iraqis talking about their daily life. A month later, terrorists struck London. In Parliament, George Galloway spoke aloud what perhaps many Londoners were thinking. After condemning the barbaric attacks and mourning the loss of innocent life, Galloway stated, "London paid the price for Britain's actions in Iraq and Afghanistan," and called for Britain to withdraw its troops from Iraq. He was immediately attacked by the government.
I found an island in your arms, country in your eyes, arms and chains, eyes and light.
We heard "My City Is Gone" by The Pretenders, "White Rabbit" by Jefferson Airplane, and "Hurt" by Johnny Cash. To hear more programs like this, go to the Action section of iraqproject.org. That's www.iraqproject.org. This is WBCRLP, 97.7 FM, Great Barrington, Massachusetts. This is Mickey Friedman, and this is The Other Side.